Welcome to Model Minority Moms, where we talk about the meaning of success in career, family, and life. We are Jeanette Park,
Kate Wong,
and Susan Liu,
Harvard classmates and Asian American working moms who get real about the pressures of fitting in while standing out.
Greetings, greetings, and welcome to another episode of Model Minority Moms. We are continuing with our divorce series, and today we have Yim Ji Nguyen, a divorce lawyer. I mean, she calls it family law, but let's be honest, it's a divorce lawyer who is joining us on the show, and she's going to be answering all these questions that is really too overwhelming to Google and giving us the skinny, spilling the tea on regrets that people have and they wish they would know maybe to not get into a situation like this. So, Ji, thanks so much for joining us on the show. Can you give us a quick bio about, you know, how long you've been a lawyer for, your experience with divorce law here in Seattle?
Thanks for having me, guys. My name is Ji. I go by Ji. I am a family law attorney, but we do a lot of divorce, parenting plan, custody, those types of things. I've been an attorney for 12 years, and of those 12 years, I've done family law for 12 years. I incidentally got into family law. I mean, I got good grades in law school for family law, but that wasn't part of my plan. But I've been doing it for 12 years. My areas of practice is mainly King County, but I also do Pierce County and Snohomish County.
Rad. And, you know, we can't talk to a professional without having a disclaimer. Jeanette, do you want to do a disclaimer?
Okay, so our disclaimer is this is not legal advice. Go consult your own attorney before taking any legal action. So we just felt like we needed to say that because we are going to be sharing legal information. So even if it may sound like advice, it is not advice. It is just information. Please go consult and get your own advice if you have to take legal action.
Thank you, Jeanette. All right, so when you're in a relationship that's not working out and you feel really stuck, and maybe there's kids here in the picture, it's really scary to figure out what are your options? What are you going to do next? And I think that's just why we're so excited to have you on the show, because it's just information, right? And I think once people have information, they're more empowered to do something or not do something. So, Ji, just give it to us. Divorce law basics. What should people know when they're considering divorce or not divorce? What should they know?
Sure. So there's obviously a plethora of information that is out there, and you can Google it, you can search it on websites, you can go to law firms, all of those things. But the most simple things that you need to know is Washington State is a no-fault state, which means the court does not consider what the reasons for the divorce are. It could be infidelity, it could be domestic violence, it could be, you know, I'm just not feeling it anymore, whatever it is. But you have to do what works for you. And so there's no wrong or right reasons for doing it per se. And as you've said, lots of people stay in it because they have kids. You know, my kids are 16, they're going to be 18 soon. I want to wait it out. My kids are really young. They need both parents in their life. I'm going to stay for it. Even though there's domestic violence, they can change. This was not the person I was. I can make those changes. So those are all factors that people think about when they are doing the divorce. But really is, you know, are you in danger? That's the first question you should ask yourself. Does this require you to get out of that danger? Are your children in danger? Those are the things that you should consider. Is maintaining this relationship good for your children and good for yourself? Are you financially stable and able to lead this divorce? Those are all sort of questions that come to mind when someone thinks about a divorce. And those are factors that you should consider before you decide whether you want to file or not.
I have a question. So when you say no-fault divorce, does that mean, because I think in some states that are not no-fault divorce states, oh, and we should maybe just say divorce law is governed at the state level, right? And so how your process works out will probably vary from state to state. So in Washington state, we are a no-fault divorce state, but I'm just want to know like more detail what that meant, because does that mean like basically the state will grant a divorce regardless of the reason? And maybe in some other states, that's not true. Like you have to have a reason that the judge deems legitimate or necessary to grant that divorce. Or does it like extend to other things, like in terms of how property is divided among the couple? So let's say if there was domestic abuse or there was like financial abuse or infidelity, I get the part like, okay, divorce will be just granted if one of the people in the marriage like want the divorce. But does that also mean that's factored into these other aspects of the divorce, like especially regarding custody, property, you know, that type of thing?
And that's a great question. So that doesn't have a straight answer. A no-fault state just basically means that the court does not consider the reason behind the filing for the divorce. Anybody can do it and the court will grant a divorce. Meaning if you have one party who wants a divorce and the other party doesn't want a divorce, whatever the reasons for those are, the court will grant a divorce. Now, the second prong to your question is, does it have an impact on the divisions of assets and liabilities and parenting plan? It does. So, for example, let's say infidelity is our first factor. When partner A cheats and partner B wants a divorce, the court is not going to say you can't get divorced because of the cheating. The court's going to say it doesn't matter what the reason is, you can get divorced. Now, does cheating play a role in the division of assets and liability? That goes into the next, what I'll call a legal term of art, community property. Washington State is also a community property state, which means anything that was acquired during the marriage is presumptively community property. And the presumption for the court is that's going to be divided 50-50. Does infidelity play a factor into the division of that? No, because when you cheat on someone, you know, there certainly is an emotional and financial aspect to that, but that does not play a role into how can we equitably divide this asset without considering factor of infidelity. Now, if domestic violence was a different factor, then yes, certainly that plays a role. Did partner A perpetrate domestic violence on partner B? And because of that, partner B has depression, trauma, needs therapy, can't go to work, can't take care of the kids. Yes, those are then factors because that spouse is then going to need support after the marriage to go to counseling, to get a job, to get back on their feet, those types of things. And so that certainly plays a role into it. If there was financial abuse, one partner was a working partner and the other partner was a stay-at-home parent. They relied heavily on that financial aspect of that person. Is there going to be a disproportionate distribution of the assets and liabilities? Certainly there can be. It's presumptively 50-50, but there are factors that can help the court decide 55-45, 60-40, 70-30. You know, so those are all encompassing factors. So when I say simply no fault, it's simply the court saying, I don't care what the reason for the divorce is, I'm going to grant the divorce. As long as one person believes that the marriage is irretrievably broken, the divorce will be granted. The determining factors of how we divide the assets, what the parenting plan are going to be, those are all going to be fact-by-fact cases.
Got it. So you mentioned, you know, and this is something we also, I know we wanted to touch on, that Washington State is a community property state. So what about other states? Could you just explain what's a community property state versus, I guess the other term is an equitable split state?
Yeah. So we call them either community or non-community or equitable split states is something I've heard as well. I'm licensed here in Washington, so I can only talk about Washington law. We have reciprocity with many other states, Oregon, which I'm linked to because I've been licensed for 5+ years.
So reciprocity, does that mean you can practice if your client is based in that other state?
So reciprocity basically just means that the states have similar laws in which I can link up with another attorney in that state if I'm not licensed in that state, and we can help a client in that state. I have other clients who live in different states, but the divorce is here in Washington, so therefore I can still litigate that issue. But if we had a case down in Oregon and I'm not licensed in Oregon, I can link up with an attorney who is licensed in Oregon, and we can work together to litigate that case in Oregon. And so reciprocity means for us, we can link up with other attorneys in other states that have similar laws that we can work together. But that bill doesn't allow me to practice because I'm not licensed in that state quite yet. Now, as far as the difference between community versus equitable split state, I know many states are community property states. I don't have the exhaustive list for you. California, Oregon, Washington, basically along the coast.
West Coast. Yeah.
Yeah. And basically what that means is the definition of community property is what was acquired during the marriage. That's presumptive community, right? And then you have assets that were acquired prior to the marriage and then were commingled. And then we have to talk about commingling. Then does it become quasi-community? Does it change its nature of the definition of the asset, those types of things? And that's sort of a deeper level of understanding. I don't think that a layperson would permissibly understand that. But community property just means what was acquired during the marriage and is presumptively 50-50 divided. Versus in other states, they might not be community property. They can say, how can we make sure that the division of this asset, whether it was acquired during the marriage or outside of the marriage or after the marriage, be divided equitably?
Wait, I just want to check for understanding. Is community property state the same thing as commonwealth law?
No.
Oh, damn.
Commonwealth law is another different thing. So Washington actually has another thing called a committed intimate relationship, which is short for CIR. And that's commonwealth or common law, and which is where the court recognizes two parties who have resided or cohabitated in a marital-like relationship, and the court mm-hmm. will allow them to divide their assets and liabilities equitably as if they were married, but there are limitations to the CIR. For example, in a CIR, you won't get spousal maintenance or alimony.
All right.
Because you're not a spouse. That specifically applies to just spouses. So if you were in a relationship for 20 years and you never got married, you're not going to get that spousal maintenance, unfortunately.
But you could get divorced.
So the word that we use is dissolution, right?
Oh, dissolution.
Or is it equivalent to that? You can dissolve a CIR and you can dissolve a marriage. So it's not called a divorce. We call it a dissolution for that reason, because you can dissolve the relationship. Versus going back to what I was saying, you could be together for 20 years. You could have children. You could have purchased properties. You could do all of this. And then you won't get spousal maintenance because it wasn't CIR. Versus if you were married for 3 years and then you acquired property, you have children, you can then ask for spousal maintenance based on the need and ability. But those are the difference between those. And so common law applies to CIRs because the court recognizes a marital-like relationship because of the length of time they've been together, because they've lived like a married couple. It will recognize. And then you have, you know, a marriage, which is where community property begins accumulating from the date you were married to the date you were separated.
So I kind of wanted to back up a little bit to your earlier point about what community property state means. So I've been getting some questions from friends about prenuptial agreements. And my understanding is that prenuptial agreements don't really have much effect in community property states because, you know, it's a community property state. Is that an accurate statement?
It's not per se all accurate, because prenuptial agreements can address that issue. I've drafted, and I've known other attorneys who draft, and then I review the prenuptial agreement where the parties can agree that even if the asset was acquired during the marriage, if mm-hmm. they trace the funds to separate properties or separate funds, they can still... I'd say that it was community property in character, but can still be precluded in a prenuptial agreement. Now, it really comes down to the validity of the prenuptial agreement. If you have an attorney who drafts you an ironclad prenuptial agreement, its validity will hold up even with a community property state. I've had lots and lots of prenuptial agreements where they will agree, even if we bought this during the marriage, what I bought is mine, what you bought is yours. So that can be addressed. Now, when it comes to litigation, anytime you want to litigate a prenuptial agreement, there's going to be one party that wants to invalidate the agreement, right?
Right.
And that then comes down to contract law. Was that contract drafted in a manner in which would hold up in court? I'll tell you from experience, most of the time people will agree to uphold the prenuptial agreement, but there are also lots of contests regarding the validity of it when it comes down to, because they're going to say it fair, but then again, contract law applies well. Did you think it was fair at the time that you signed it? If it was, then it is.
Wait, tangential question. When family law lawyers go to a family law conference and have a dance party, do you guys play the Kanye West song, "We Want Prenup"?
It definitely has been played. I fully heard it. But he's on point. His verse is very on point in that song. So, you know, I don't disagree with what he said.
Okay, now I'm curious, since we're going there. People who do prenups have a higher likelihood of getting divorced, or are they just like in billionaire families? It's so fascinating to me to be like, that was my couch and it's always been my couch. You know, it's my heirloom or whatever. You know what I mean? Or is it like trust fund babies that really get into this? I'm so curious if it's like signaling a lack of faith in the relationship.
The concept of a prenuptial agreement has always been it's somebody who has a ton of money and they want to protect that asset. And it's true to some extent, but most of my prenuptial agreements do have a lot of assets. And it could be anywhere between, you know, I have value of $100,000 up to a couple $100 million, whatever it is, right? Prenuptial agreement covers anybody on any basis. And whenever someone comes in to me for a prenuptial agreement, you know, I don't think it necessarily signals divorce. It's protection of assets for them, right? And it's something they work hard to build. So you have many scenarios. You have... you know, for lack of a better word, mail order.
Gold diggers.
Right. Yeah. Those types, right? You have those. That makes sense. You have people who are older in age who want to protect what they have acquired prior before. People who have been divorced before will want to have prenuptial agreements because of the community property state law. And they have many, many millennials who are like us and who say, I don't want this to be a messy divorce if we end up getting divorced. I want it to be amicable. I want to remain friends, those types of things. So I don't necessarily think that a prenuptial agreement signals the divorce, but the negotiation process of a prenuptial agreement will bring up many issues which have resulted for me in some cases of the marriage not happening.
Mm.
Oh, I just wanted to ask about the one layer deeper on the community property, because my understanding is that the dates matter, right? Like when you actually get married and when you actually, I think it's called date of separation. So just for context, my parents went through a divorce in my early 20s. And, you know, we can talk about the different ways to get divorced, but my parents basically opted for the DIY solution and I was their DIYer. So I became more familiar with this stuff. But basically, my understanding of some of the ideas around community property, which is really just like a starting point, right? It's the starting assumption. And then there could be a lot of modifications after that. But it's like when you got married matters, right? And that's really the date that you register to get married. And then the date of separation, which is not a legal date necessarily. Like that's not the date your divorce is granted. But the date when, and I think it differs by state, but it's when one partner moved out, or basically it's the earliest date when one partner says, okay, we're no longer together. And then the idea of community property is everything that you accumulated between those two dates. And so in the scenario where you're a wealthy person and maybe you're older and you get married to somebody else in a different financial situation, my understanding is that the assets that you bring into the marriage are supposed to be mostly separate, and maybe the growth of those assets is what's considered shared. And then I think there might be like another kind of, at least this is the starting point, like an exception for any gifts you received during your marriage, right? So let's say one of your parents passed and you got an inheritance, like that is also maybe considered more separate. So anyway, I just wanted to go one level deeper and just ask about those things. We don't have to go into super detail, but if you could just talk a little bit about it, that would be helpful.
You hit the nail on the head on many issues of what we divulge in when we differentiate, separate assets and things like that. So first of all, as to the date range, the date of marriage is never going to change. That's the date you register your marriage. Whether you do it through the thing and have a ceremony, separate date, the date you register for the marriage, the date that you become married is the date of marriage, right? The date of separation is really where most of the argument lies, because the date of separation plays a big role in what is community versus what is separate, right? The date of separation can be various ways. The date somebody moved out of the home, the date the two of you agreed that your community ended, the date the two of you separated your assets and financials, because I have a lot of people who contemplate divorce, right? But we got to stay together for the kids, but let's go ahead and separate our stuff. And that's the date they, but you have to take actions that signify the termination of the gathering of community property. So for example, you separate the money in your joint bank account, your closed bank account. That action clearly signals that the intent is to terminate your community property, right? But if you do that, and then you take your money from your separate property and you continue to pay for things in the community, that signals that the community is still present because you're still combining your resources, right? So those facts are going to determine whether that date of separation is important or not. And a lot of people focus in on the date of separation because the date of separation controls how much do I have to split of my retirement, my 401k. And if I bought a car right after we broke up, is that car community property since I bought it, but the date of separation is contested? Right. And then what you say is, yes, when you have someone who is older and who comes into the marriage with separate assets, because the character of the asset maintains its character unless it's been commingled. So if partner A has a house and that they bought prior to the marriage and then they come into the marriage, that asset is separate property. There's no doubt about it. And what you touched on was the equity that is earned in that asset is then, yes, community property because it was earned during the marriage. Because if that house was $300,000 at the time you brought it in, and then during your marriage, by the end of your marriage, by your date of separation, it's appraised at $1 million. That appreciation in equity is then can be considered community property, right? But then the court goes back to, is it fair and equitable? Did that partner B contribute to that asset? Did they pay the mortgage? Did they pay property tax? Did they pay the landscaper? You know, whatever it is. Now, did partner B share the rental income? Did they, you know, ask for help with paying property tax? All of those things are factors that the court is going to consider to determine whether that equity should be divided. There's no doubt that equity was earned during the marriage. And yes, that applies to lots of things. Your retirement income, your homes that appreciate, your bank accounts that, you know, inflate, your IRAs that appreciate because of the market, whatever it is. But at the same time, you also have to take the loss. You can't take the appreciation without the depreciation. So that asset loses, or whatever it is, the other person has the argument that you can't just take the appreciation, you got to pick the depreciation. And that factor leads a lot of people to say, what you brought in is yours, what I brought in is mine, we're not going to fight about that. But there will be people who will be petty and will say, well, there's $10,000 in equity and increase in your house that you brought in, I want that. Now, gifts, inheritances, there are specific rules that say those are separate property, can't be touched. Personal injury claims are different, right? Because they're yours. You're the one who suffered the pain and suffering, right? That's your money. But I suffered loss of consortium. You know, you, my partner couldn't do A, B, and C because of this injury. Therefore, I should be entitled. So those are more deeper analysis of how you decipher what is separate property, what is community property, what is quasi-community property, and what is separate property after separation. So all of those would be issues litigated. But for the most part, when people come to a divorce, you know, they get a headache from just trying to decipher all of this. And at the end of the day, it really comes down to what number would make you happy. And that's what happens in mediation. At some point in time, they're just like, okay, we're not even going to argue about this anymore. What number would make you happy and make this all go away? So yes, those are all things that will be considered and will be litigated. And the biggest aspect to dissolution is, how do we equitably divide the assets and liabilities? How do we classify the assets? How do we classify the debts? And certainly, yes, those things will all be factors that are going to be taken into consideration in division of those assets and liabilities.
It seems like a very emotional thing. Maybe if I'm in the middle of discovering something terrible and then I'm like, I want a dissolution. And then it's your number might change, you know, like a year after separation, or, oh man, we are really bleeding each other in whatever we're doing with each of our lawyers. So maybe can you walk me through what are the options? You know, I always think of people's court and Judge Judy, you know, as a layperson, right? But what percentage of the time is it just mediation where it's like, okay, you're my lawyer, and then this is my number. You go talk to them and you call me back right when you know. What is happening here? What are the choices?
So everybody can be persuaded. Everybody has a number that outruns the headache. Okay. So mediation is quite successful. 90% of my cases settle in mediation. It's very rare that a family law case goes to trial because trials are expensive. Mm-hmm. You're talking about my clients paying me $30,000 to $60,000 to litigate their case. And then the other side paying. At the end of the day, the two of you are spending $60,000 to $100,000 to litigate these issues when you could be spending that on your kids, spending that on a vacation. That is always a selling point for me in mediation. I say, I'm happy to take $30,000 from you because that's going to give me, my family, a vacation. But don't you think you'd rather put that into your kids' college education? And that always triggers a chord with somebody automatically. Because they're so wrapped up in, I got to stick it to the other person. I got to take what they can. I got to take what's fair for me. But they don't consider the ramifications of doing all of that, right? Like, you could be going on vacation, those types of things. So, as I said, 90% of it is settled in mediation. When we go into mediation, me and my client are in one room. The other side and their attorney are in the other room. The mediator goes back and forth between the rooms. It's rare that we put everybody together in a mediation, because what happens is, they're going to just scratch and fight and yell and scream, and nothing productive happens. Because you're paying for the mediator, you're paying for your lawyer, and they're paying for their lawyer. It's a lot of lawyers' fees that is being paid for them to yell, oh, that's not what happened. You know that's not what happened. This is actually what happened. Oh, no, that's not what happened. I can't believe you're saying that now. So that's what we're trying to prevent by separating everyone.
Oh, what is this? Is it happening like in a Marriott ballroom? Or is it like at a WeWork, a decrepit WeWork? Or where...
So the mediator, prior to COVID, mediation would happen in person at the mediator's office. It could also happen at one of the attorney's office if we have separate conference room, basically to separate everyone. But now everything's happening over Zoom, and we are putting out in breakout rooms, and the mediator goes back and forth between. Again,
cheap.
There's also the preference for them to be together. If they're amicable and they want to do that, we all advise against it. The mediator and the two attorneys will say, I don't think that's a good idea, but if you really, really want to, we can agree to it.
If
no
they
problem.
Can do that, then why would they need a mediator?
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the issue. They can't even do that. Before we get to mediation, I always say, what can we agree to? We'll throw offers. And they'll, no, not talking about this. We're going to litigate this, right? But mediation is mandatory in Washington State, which means the court is going to make you go talk to each other before they'll let you go to trial. The only exception is if you were a victim of domestic violence, you are not required to face your perpetrator. Therefore, we can waive mediation. But mediation always happens the same way. We preface our story to the mediator. We say, this is what wife is saying, or this is what husband is saying. These are the assets they have. This is what we think the assets are valued at. This is what is owed on it. This is what the equity is. This is our proposal for the division. This is a parenting plan. Mom or dad has been the primary parent. This is a schedule we want. This is dad's income. This is mom's income. This is what child support is. This is what our proposal is. This is why mom needs spousal maintenance. She's been a stay-at-home mom. She or dad needs spousal maintenance. Dad has been a stay-at-home parent. They haven't worked. They need to go back to school. All of those things. This is what we want. There's not a magic way for us to calculate spousal maintenance, but for us as attorneys, or at least for me, I say every 4 years of marriage, you get 1 year of spousal maintenance. And then the amount depends on what's the ability versus what's the need. Can they go back to school? They, you know, can they earn the same as this person? What is the potential future earning of each party? So then we throw all of that at the mediator. So the mediator gets all of that information from both sides. And mediators are people who've been doing family law for like 100 years, or they're retired judges. So they know what a judge is likely to rule. So their position is real strong. They can say, you know, I'm going to tell you, this is what I think the judge is going to rule. You're going to spend $30,000 to fight over $5,000 doesn't make any sense. So then we have all this information from both ends. Mediator comes in. Mediator says to me, hey, here's your proposal. I see it. Here's where I think you're going to have the issues. And then what can we agree? Then we throw some numbers back and forth. At the end of the day, after you list, everybody has a chart. Everything you list everything out, you say their total asset during the marriage is $1 million. Their total liabilities is $500,000. There's $500,000. Presumptively, everybody gets $250,000. But mom is a stay-at-home. Mom hasn't worked for 20 years. Dad is a primary breadwinner. Dad earns five times mom earning. That's going to shift the percentage because mom's going to need an upper hand to start her life separately. So then it becomes, okay, $200,000 for dad, $300,000 for mom. And then, okay, well, I'd only agree to that because A, B, and C, whatever it is. Then it shifts back and down. And then they come, literally comes down to a number. And sometimes after we get to a number, it doesn't even make sense anymore with the division. It's just what number will make you happy and make you go away. And that's the reality of what mediation is. I have lots of clients who start out very cool. I want everything 50-50. I want 50% of the equity of the house. I want 50% of the equity of his car. I want 50% of his retirement. I want 50% in the bank account, all of those things. And we're talking about like $50 of a account. You really want to split $25? You're paying me more than that than 10 minutes to argue this. Is this really what you want to do? So that's then how it happens in mediation. And a lot of time, it's us playing devil's advocate, telling our clients, this is your position. This is what I think I can prove. But the judge can also say this, and this is how they prove it. And then you tell them that, and then that gets the wheels spinning, like I say. You know, I've had people spend $30,000 to fight over $1,500. Like, that makes absolutely no sense to me. And that's what we have to do and tell them. Doesn't make any sense.
Can I ask, if you went the mediation route, what is an average cost there?
Sure. So mediators, like I said, are people who have done family law for a long time or are retired judges. So their hourly rate is equivalent, if not more, than what the attorneys charge. So mediation can range anywhere from $250 an hour up to $450 an hour, right? That's attorney's rate. And mediation can go for as long as you want to go. My longest mediation was for 17 hours.
What?
Like, great? Nope. Great. We went from 9 a.m. to 1:30 a.m. the next day. The mediator agreed to stay. I agreed to stay. The other attorney agreed to stay. The parties agreed to stay because they were so close.
And then did the wife go, this is what it's like to be in labor. This is the labor tax. Give me a little bit more.
There is always going to be a remark. But even after they've agreed, see, this is what we get into. This is why you do this, you do this. There's never going to be a stop of faulting the other party. And that's for us as attorneys. I think we're jaded to it. We're kind of like, Okay, I hear you. And I hear that's bullshit.
I'm sorry.
And I don't want to address that. My goal is to address how we can both walk away. And the thought process for mediation always is, I tell my clients, you have to walk in here thinking you're not going to get everything you want. You have to walk away with what you can live with. Okay. But
yeah.
Nobody is happy walking out of mediation, right. But nobody is happy walking out of trial either, because you have a judge who doesn't know about your case as well as you do. And now is making the decision for you that you have to follow.
So like mediation, you're looking at attorney fees, the mediator's fees. So it's like basically like $1,000 an hour. $1,000 per every hour of mediation that you're doing, it sounds like.
Plus the attorney prep, right?
Yeah.
So ballpark, what is this, G? Is this like 10 grand?
Mediation is going to run you between 6 to 8 grand.
All in.
All in. I mean, we're going like, you know, sometimes the mediator buys lunch. It depends on the mediator, but sometimes they will buy lunch. But with that 17-hour We didn't have no lunch break, no nothing. Everybody was just snacking in between. So it's intense. And you know what? People get tired, right? By the fifth hour. I don't know why I'm still talking about this, but those two individuals were really, you know, strong-headed, each individual. And it took all of us. And by the end of it, the attorneys and the media were just like, look, this is the last offer. And there will be tears. We're like, this is the last offer. Take it or leave it. And then they'll leave it. And they'll be like, okay, we're so close. So it's never really that it's the last offer.
Oh my
That's God. A lot when it's willing to continue.
I think it's hard because you're like obviously coming in with a lot of high emotions. And then a lot of this stuff is, you know, like, face it. I mean, there are some math to it, but some of it is like fairly subjective, right? Like, how much did you contribute while doing this? Because, and how much did this thing really like, you know, yeah. Like,
there has been a lot of talk about, have you guys seen the one where it interviews a person who says you have to work 100 hours per week? You can't be allowed to sit down, stand up, whatever. They were describing a stay-at-home parent and they were interviewing individuals to see if they would ever take on a job like that, right? And it was so funny because the interview questions sound just like interview questions, but they didn't realize they were being interviewed to be a stay-at-home parent. They thought it was just a job. They say, hey, you work 100 hours per week. You aren't allowed to stand up or you can't allow to sit down. You don't really have a lunch. You don't really have a break. You have to wake up in the middle of the night. And so the applicant were like, isn't that against the law? Don't I get breaks, those types of things? And at the end, they reveal this is what a stay-at-home parent does.
Well, like, how do you value that?
Exactly. That's what it is, right? It comes down to that. So one partner is going to say, I worked all the time to provide and support for this family. And, you know, the stigma is you're a stay-at-home parent. You really don't do the type of work that I do. Well, that's not true. How do you value a stay-at-home parent? Because who's taking your kids to all the activities? Who's changing their clothes, giving them baths, feeding them, all of those things? That really struck a chord with me because I was like, my God, I could never be a stay-at-home parent. I mean, I stayed home one day. My kids are 8 and 4. I stayed home one day with two of them. And I was like, I can't. I'm going to lose it. You know, and that was 8 hours of my life. But that's what I'm saying, that it really comes down to that emotional aspect. And lots of judges will. And again, it's subjective to the judge, right? Because the judge could be a female judge who was a parent and had to go through a birthing process and, you know, raising the child and 3 months of maternity leave and all of those things. It could be a male judge who could, you know, be like, I don't really know what all that is about, but I understand what she's going through, all of those types of things. So subjectively, this judge might have different opinions and their world experience or life experience will play a factor into how they make that decision as to the valuation of a stay-at-home parent. And so one partner is always going to say, I work, I brought home the money, I took you on vacation, the kids went to private school, you got whatever you asked for, you know. And then the mom's, well, you never did the dishes, you never helped with the garbage, you never took the kids anywhere, you never had time for any of those things. So those are the competing factors. And that's why it's so emotional when you do family law. And it's funny, one of the first few questions I always get asked is, are you married? And I was like, yes, I am happily married, you know, for the last decade. And I have two beautiful children. And they're like, well, how can you do this? It's because it's my job to put perspective for you that this is one aspect of your life. It is not your entire life. And I want to help you progress and move on from this and move on with your life. And that's a lot of times it's me playing therapist also.
Yeah.
Family lawyers are therapists. Just so you know, I have, you know, a side therapy gig that I... No, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
Literally what it is, you know, and we as family law attorneys, we work weekends, we work nights, we work late because things happen.
Yeah.
It always happens when there's a school break, there's a holiday, somebody's not giving the kids, somebody's not dropping off the kids, somebody's doing something.
Yeah.
One call all the time.
My parents' divorce was not an amicable divorce. I would just put it that way. But I think one thing that was maybe simpler is that they did clearly agree on how their assets should be divided. This was in California. So obviously Washington State might be different, but there is also like the option of just, you don't even go through mediation because the two couples can agree on what they can live with and what they think is fair between them and, you know, save on mediation fees. Like the way that my parents did it is there was this service where essentially the people involved, or in my parents' case, me, was like filling out all the forms, but there was a clinic that would provide guidance on what are the right forms to fill out, what's the process, but you would be doing a lot of the legwork. So anyway, so I just wanted to like point that out as a potential option, I would imagine here in Washington State as well.
Yeah, that's definitely an option. First of all of the family law forms are available on the court's website for you to download, print out, free of charge. If you go to the courthouse, there is what is called a family law facilitator's office, and that's specific to King County, but the other counties have something similar to that. And basically, it's a person who may or may not be an attorney, but they know all the forms that need to be filled out. They can answer general questions. They'll tell you what needs to be filled out, and you're required to fill out and do all the legwork and file all those things. And don't get me wrong, you can definitely get a divorce without an attorney, but when it is contentious and there's so much litigation, that's when it gets difficult. But if two parties can come in and just say, I just want to get divorced, you can keep the house, I will keep the car, we'll split the kids this way, you know, this is what you can pay me in child support and I'll be happy. Those can all happen, and the facilities office can help you draft all of it and get it all done. So there's, by all means, DIY is definitely an option, but those apply to people who are amicable and can talk to each other and have an agreement as to, I don't want to spend this money on a lawyer. You don't want to spend this money on a lawyer. Let's just agree. So those are definitely scenarios that can happen. And then you have cases where people have lots of assets and there are lots of disputes about it. And those people have the money to do a high, strong litigation. And then you have people who are fighting about petty, small things and then spending more money than they have. So you have all those things. But DIY is definitely always an option. And if there is agreement as to the terms of it, you can simply fill out all of the forms on your own with the help of the facilitator, pay the filing fee, and then wait 90 days and your divorce will be finalized.
Wait, gee, I have to interject. What's the weirdest thing that people all have fought over? Like a Beanie Baby collection? You know, like something where you're like, where is this going? Tell me.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't recall all of the weird things I've had, but yes, the Beanie Baby was a case.
No.
It is a true case. They got all their Beanie Babies, and in court with the judge, they divided which Beanie Baby belonged to which person. That's a real case. People here fight about everything right now.
My mom is very attached to her Beanie Baby collection. So, I mean, my parents, I don't think will ever get divorced, nor will my dad contest it, but she's very attached to her Beanie Baby collection.
But that's what I'm saying. There are sentimental attachments to things that are beyond explanation. Right now, I have a distillation case where they are fighting about the galvanized metal pipe inside of one of their homes. I said, I'm sorry, what? We can't replace this. No, it has sentimental value. That metal was from my grandparents. You know, that's the type of thing that we're fighting about. But I've had people fight about, you know, cars. I've had people fight about specific toys. I've had people fight about clothes for their kids. I've had people fight about stamp collections. I've had people fight about guns. I've had people fight about Bitcoins. This new life of litigation, all assets are disclosed and Bitcoin wallets. Well, I can't remember the password. Well, you better figure out that password. You know, we have people fighting about trees, plants. We have people fighting about pets. Oh my God, I had this whole case about these two French bulldogs. And it was so funny because they were saying, you know, he hit me in front of the dogs as if they were children, right? Because there's case law that says children who witness domestic violence are the same as victims of domestic violence. So that's very important when you come to a parenting plan. But these two were equating their two French bulldogs as children. And he hit me in front of children. He yelled me in front of children. He would scare the dog. And the judge would keep having to say, Washington State does not recognize animals as children. They are assets. So how much did you pay for this dog? I paid $5,000 for this dog. Okay, well, you're going to pay him $2,500 for this dog, right? Because it's an asset. But it was such an intense argument about these two French bulldogs. And it came down to, here's testimony from the babysitters for the dog. Here's testimony from the vet. So all sorts of strange things happen. But people fight about anything and anything. And when they have set their mind to an issue, they will make it a bigger issue than it really is. So that's really the other aspect of us sort of having to reel our client down from cloud. And I'd be like, you're paying me $300-$400 an hour to talk about what your significant other or spouse is feeding your dog.
Well, I'm interested in seeing the French bulldog testimony, you know, hear it from Fluffy herself.
And there were videos submitted of how happy the dogs were when they were with partner A versus partner B and what the dogs look like, whether their faces were clean and stuff. So it's not out of the ordinary to rely on those types of evidence to decipher who was the better dog parent.
Noted.
Ask a personal question after all this.
Kate, I feel Kate has a dog, by the way.
Her name is Wong, my surname, and it's very clear that she belongs to me. So if my husband and I ever get divorced, she belongs to me. There's no question about that.
Kate has a sweater with her dog's name embroidered on it.
It was a Christmas present from my husband, though. It's her face. Anyway, that's not the personal question. Just hearing you recount all of these scenarios, which may seem really ridiculous to us, but in the heat of the moment, it's very personal to these people. Maybe some of the stabbing like that. It's a reflection of the people's mental state, right? And how badly this relationship has gone. Anyway, I'm just curious, you seeing all this, how do you keep your calm slash like not bitch slap your client when they're being really ridiculous? You know what I mean? Because I feel like, I'm sure you haven't even begun to tell us some of the ridiculous things you've seen. I'm just curious personally.
Oh, no, there is no doubt that I tell my clients straight to them. My job is their attorney. My job is to get what's fair for them, not to cater to their ridiculousness. So I will tell them, I will say it to their face. And I think it might come with how long you do this. With newer attorneys, they kind of tiptoe and they gently say stuff. But me, I've been doing this for a decade. I'm like, that is complete and utter BS. You really want to fight about this BS? Okay, let's talk about how you're going to fight for this BS and what the outcomes are going to be. So I'm very direct with my client. When they bring BS, I will call out their BS and say, you want to do this? I'm advising you not to do this. And if you don't want to do that, we're not. I don't have to continue to be your attorney, right? And that sets them back real quick. And I always have to, you know, start out the conversation with my clients with expectations. When I do consultations and when the client retains, I set expectations very clearly. I say, if you demand BS, I'm going to call you on the BS and I'm going to tell you I'm not going to do your BS. And if you're not happy with it, we can end our relationship, right? Because I am in the control position where I do not have to take their BS and they can take their BS to someone else who will tiptoe and cater to them. That's the difference. And I think that has to do with, again, the length of time I've been doing this and the amount of crazy stuff that I've seen. So nothing really fazes me anymore when clients say stuff to me. So I'm not afraid to call them out on the BS and say, that is not in the best interest of your children. I had a case. And this is just all going to have to come to examples to see what we deal with. I had a client. His wife alleged he harassed her, right? First, she wanted to say he was perpetrating domestic violence. I successfully said, this is not domestic violence. And then she says, he is harassing me. Court says, okay, that seems harassing. And what does he do? He's allowed to come to the house to get his things, right? And in your head, you're thinking, okay, you come to the house, you get your things, whatever it is, no big deal. He came in his wedding suit to get his belongings from the house. And I said, what in your right mind makes you think wearing your wedding suit to your ex-wife's house to gather your belonging is not harassment? Tell me. He didn't have a response, right? And I said, now the judge is going to extend this harassment because of your behavior, because the court needs to see that you're not going to continue to engage in acts of harassment. What did you do? You showed up in a wedding suit. Why did you have to wear the wedding suit? You could have worn sweatpants. You could have worn any other suit, any of that, right? Would have made sense. But that's what I'm saying. In the heat of the moment, people don't reflect on what they're doing is ridiculous and weird and not helping their case. And it is my job to say, don't do it. Don't do that. And it's sad that I have to treat my clients like five-year-olds sometimes, because when they come into that, like you said, emotions are high and they're not thinking logically. And it's my job to say, that's not going to happen. And I don't think you should do that. I don't think you need to do that. That's ridiculous.
I'm going to just bring us back to, sorry, for me, I feel like I want listeners to walk away with just like having a lay of the land so they aren't like, oh, well, actually, that's a huge surprise and going to make a huge impact on my financial situation or my childcare situation or whatnot. So anyway, in that vein, I want to ask, what are like the most surprising things for your clients in terms of finding out new information about the legal implication of something they did or their situation about splitting assets and alimony, you know, sharing custody and child support? You know, I feel like those are the big buckets, right, of what has the most impact on people's lives and what they care about. What do you feel like clients say the most? Oh, I didn't know actually that it was going to, like, the law treats my situation this way.
Sure. That happens a lot with bank accounts, right? When people get married, everybody opens a joint bank account. Well, not everybody, but most people open a joint bank account. And obviously, you know that any money you put in there is considered community and you split it up. Now, a lot of people do this where they open a joint account and then they each have separate accounts. And they put half of their paychecks into a joint account and then they put the other half of their paychecks into their separate accounts. The presumption is, this is my separate account, it's my name only, you know, it's my money, we only put in what's in there. And then they come to find out, no, that's all addressed. Because why? We're a community property state. The income was earned during the marriage. Even if you put it in a separate account, that's just commingling your separate property. So people are always super surprised to come up to find that out because they thought they safeguarded their separate account by splitting up the account. And then when I tell them, no, that's not the case. And so what will happen is they have a lot of funds funneling into the separate account. And they have the thought process that's all separate. And it might very be, you know, but the issue with the court is now they're going to say, you have this bank account that's in your name. There's $50,000 in it. How do I know what part of the $50,000 came from your separate funds versus community funds? How do I know what of that $50,000 has been spent? So at the end of the day, you now have this $50,000 that you presume was yours that is going to be addressed and be divided. So that's always a surprising factor for people. Now, as far as the parenting plan, there are always surprises. They're going to say, oh, you know, my husband or my wife was never involved with the children. And now all of a sudden they're taking them to the park. They're taking them to go buy ice cream. They're going to their sporting events. They're sending emails to the teacher. There are so many people who create evidence once they have had this thought of divorce, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not to say, but there's always one person who's always more prepared than the other person, and they've planned this, they planted this. They knew they wanted to get divorced, but they're not going to do it right away because they need to create evidence that they were involved to ensure the children go to them so that they don't have to pay child support. So many cases come about of people wanting the children because they don't want to pay child support, but they never really look at what's best interest of the children. How do we prove that? Because it's just relying on people's testimony, right? No one goes into a marriage and think, I have to make sure I take pictures of me and my kids. I have to make sure I write a journal. I have to make sure the teachers know that I'm coming to the teacher-parent conferences and have written documentation of that. All of those things, those are not things you think about when you get married. So when someone is planning, you will see because there's a change in their pattern, a change in their behavior. And that's how you counter argue that. You say, well, prior to 2023, here's what I did, all of these things, and this person was never involved. But then all of 2024, they did it because they knew they were preparing for divorce. So those are always sort of surprising factors. It's hard to answer that question in terms of what can you anticipate in a divorce. But everyone knows going into divorce, you have to divide your asset. You have to divide your liabilities. You have to talk about a parenting plan if there are children. And with the parenting plan, you have to talk about child support and then spousal maintenance and attorney's fees. Those are all the big bucket items. For the parenting plan and the child support, I mean, child support is standard. There's only one method to calculate that, right? And it's the hard part to prove about child support is how do you prove what the person's income is? Because the method of calculation is the same. Dad's income plus mom income equals total income. And then total income, there's a chart. How many kids do you have? What's the total income? This is what child support is. You take mom's income divided by the total income to get a percentage. You take that percentage, you multiply by the number on the chart to get what child support is going to be. That calculation is across the board, doesn't say. So how do people fight that? The other surprising factor is how do they conceal their income, right? What if a person was working for cash only? What happened if a person worked at a nail salon and only made minimum wage, but they got cash tips? How do you account for those types of things? What if a person has a bunch of cash from selling a property abroad and then that cash is kept somewhere in secret? We don't know. So the hardest thing to prove is cash. If someone says he or she works as a manicurist, they only make $15 an hour and they get this tip. But look, they have all this cash. Well, how do we prove that? We can't prove that. Cash is the most difficult thing to prove. And there's no way for me to say, we know this person has $30,000 in cash and that needs to be divided. No one comes in thinking, how do I prove that they have this $30,000? But one of those factors to do is, well, they bought a Mercedes Benz, well, they go out to these fancy dinners, they go on these trips, how are they affording this? It doesn't equate with someone who earns $15 an hour to drive a Mercedes Benz and to go to Hawaii every other month or something like that. So those are sort of things that you have to think about when you come into litigation. And that's not anything anyone who represents themselves think about. And those are issues that will come out when you do that. But in essence, when you come into a divorce, you just need to make sure that you make a list for yourself. What are our assets? How did I contribute? What is the fair division of them? How can I prove that I was the primary parent for the children? How do I prove what my income is? And after divorce, what are my expenses? What am I short based on my income? What do I need? So those are questions that you really want to ask yourself if you're preparing to go into a divorce.
Okay, wait, I want to double click a couple of these things. So how do you prove you're a primary parent?
Primary parent is hard because how do you prove that? The most common thing is I was a stay-at-home parent, but that means that I'm the primary parent. That's not always the case. It's true most of the time, but you can be a stay-at-home parent, but you can also be an absent parent, right? But the way that you prove it is you say, so I always tell my client, there's a difference between saying I was the one who cared for the kids all the time. I did everything for them. I was involved with them versus saying kids wake up at 6 a.m. They brush their teeth at 6:30. They get down for breakfast at 7:15. They love cereal and milk. It has to be chocolate milk. They like only Lucky Charms. They get out the door at this time. This is their class. This is their teachers. This is the class they take. These are what their grades are. You see the difference? That's how you prove you're a primary parent, the details. Because everyone's going to come in. I have so many cases where they come in and one parent says, I have always been involved in my kid's life. I am the primary parent. I took care of them, all of this. But then you have the other parent. So when I do declarations and stuff for my clients, I was like, I don't care what you say. I want you to tell me the details. Like, tell me what cereal they like, what they like to eat, what they're allergic to. What time do they go to school? What sports do they play? Who are their teammates? Who are their friends? How do you pick them up? How do you drop them off? What car? Where do they sit? Those types of things are what proves you are the primary parent. Because if you are the primary parent, you will know these details just easy for you to come out versus the other person just saying, I just had this case this morning was just that. Dad says I was the primary parent. And mom says, no, he wasn't. And how did we prove it? I told my client, go get all your doctor's notes. Ask the doctor to write down how many times you came with the kids, how many times he came with the kid. Go ask their sports teacher who dropped them off, who picks them up. We had to prove all of that to establish she was primary parent. And the court, based on that, says, yep, I believe her that she's the primary parent. I'm not saying you weren't involved. I'm just saying based on the evidence that's been provided, she was the primary parent because she went to the doctors with them 109 times and you went 8 times. She knew what school they went to. She knew all of their teachers' names. You don't know any of that.
I want to ask this question. So say a parent is trying to avoid child support maintenance and they do that by, say, getting 50-50 custody of each kid. Okay, so say they get 50-50 custody and they're like, oh, shit, this is actually really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid's not having a good time with that other parent. Do they come back to you? And then it's renegotiated? Like, after the dissolution, how many re-ups are they coming back for additional services? You know, like, how messy does this get? Is it just, hey, it happens all the way until they're 18 or when the kids stop talking to us and don't give any F's about us? But you know what I mean? One parent's fighting for the kids, but they actually don't really want the kids and the kids don't want to be there. Like, can you talk a little bit about that?
Happens all the time. It rarely happens when a judge will grant that 50-50 based on that because the evidence will prove who is the primary parent and they will always place the children with the person who has historically been the primary parent. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It does happen. But in the event that it does happen, the judge says, okay, 50-50. And then parent A says, oh man, this is really hard. I don't want to take care of these kids. I can't take them to school. This doesn't work with my work schedule. They can always come back and agree to change the parenting plan. Because parenting plans are really hard to modify. Because the condition for modification of a parenting plan is a substantial change in circumstances. So it has to be substantial. It can't be like, I don't have time to take the kids. That's not a substantial change. You should have known that when you asked for what you asked for. Substantial change is when parent is neglecting the child, is abusing the child's health, mental, physical, emotional, is detrimental by living with one parent. So it's a really high burden to establish, to modify a parenting plan. Okay. So you may get what you want, but if you're not able to do it, the only way to change it is come back, agree to the other person, and change the parenting plan. And that can be changed as many times as agreement is king. If you two can agree on whatever, the court is not going to say that unless the court thinks it's not in the best interest of the children. Because the standard here in Washington State is what is in the best interest of the children. And the best interest of the children is maintained by stability, consistency, you know, regularity for them. So if you're somebody who works Monday to Friday, 8 to 5, you need to figure out how you're going to drop these kids off at school. You're going to figure out how you pick them up. You're going to figure out if they have after school care until you come home, all of those things. And a lot of people will do it for the basis of child support. But when they actually get into it, they realize, oh my God, I can't do this. And it's going to be a parent because if one parent can't take them to school, what are they? They either tardy to school or they miss school. And then the other parent's going to say, this is the weeks that they've been with, you know, the other parent, and this is how much school they've missed. I've gotten letters that says they're going to be held back. They're going to come back to court and change it real quick because that's affecting them with their educational. And that then becomes a substantial change and they can modify the parenting plan. And then you can also bring someone back to court for contempt. Let's say they have a 50-50 schedule, right? That means 1 week with dad, 1 week with mom. Exchanges on Sundays at 6, right? On the weeks that dad has them, dad calls mom and says, I can't take them. Can you keep them? Dad does this once every month. Mom's going to come back and say, he can't even keep up with the schedule. He shouldn't be entitled to have this schedule. We need to change it. That's an adjustment, though. Or let's say that mom and dad has 50-50, right? And then dad takes the kids, but they miss all of their school days. They don't get their homework done. They don't get to their extracurricular activities. They're not getting fed. Dad is having girlfriend watch them or whatever it is. All of those things are things that mom can raise as concerns to dad. And when she raises enough concerns, she can bring him back to court for contempt. Say, this is what the parenting plan says. You're not doing it. And you're not doing it because you are not doing it in good faith. you're neglecting the children. The court can find the parent in contempt for not following the plan that the court issued, because that's an intentional violation of an order that is in place. And when you have contempt 2 times in 3 years, that's grounds for modification. So it goes on until they're 18. It doesn't even terminate at 18 because you have college education that you talk about, that child support.
Oh, God, you're in this long-term relationship with your ex.
And that's, you have to learn how to co-parent. And that's what my therapist side says. You got to co-parent with this person for another 16 years. Do you really want to fight about, you know, do I get my beanie baby? It's a lot of counseling.
Yeah. But I mean, in some ways, it's like interesting, too, because I imagine some of those issues might have been present in their marriage. And now they have to hash it out in front of a judge who's going to make the decision for them.
Oh, I have so many questions. But wait, so do all lawyers offer free consults? Or like, okay, say, I want to get a divorce. Then do I just like, we don't use Yellow Pages anymore. But like,
yeah, what's your advice for getting a good attorney?
With attorneys nowadays, we're present everywhere online. You can Google us, you can Yelp us, you can go to, what's it called? What's Avo, which is attorney ranking, whatever it is. So not all attorneys offer free consultation. Most attorneys actually charge for consultation because you're getting information at my expense of my time. So they will bill for it. I personally do not charge for consultation, but my consultations are limited to 30 minutes to 45 minutes. And the way that I do consultation is I break out the entire process, the procedures of how a divorce works from beginning to end. And then I let them ask any questions they have about their particular case. Because the spiel I give at the beginning is the procedural aspect of it. And it's a lot of things that they're not going to understand, but they at least have a gist of what's going to happen in that 1 year timeline. Then they ask their specific question. And those are the questions that come into place, like, what happens if I do this? What do I do with this account? What do I do with this? Do I claim kids on taxes? How do I prove those types of things? And then after that, we talk about the cost and things.
I have a quick question. I know we need to wrap up, but I've seen in a lot of forums where women are asking about divorce, one piece of common advice I see is that you should consult with as many divorce lawyers as possible, because once you consult with a divorce lawyer, then your spouse can't.
Nah, that happened to me.
Is that true or not? Because
it is true.
I see it so much on the forums. Yeah.
Yes, it is definitely true. So we as lawyers have ethical rules we have to follow. And ethical rules requires that if we consult with a prospective client, we are not allowed to represent the adverse party because we have sensitive information about the person we consulted with. So yes, if partner A goes and consults with 15 attorneys and then partner B consults with those same 15 attorneys, the partner B is going to be notified, hey, I consulted with partner A and I'm precluded from representing you because of this. Unless partner A authorizes it. That happened to me actually recently. I had a consult with a client for a divorce and then she didn't retain me. And then later on, husband came by and husband retained me for a protection order. And she says, you can't represent him because you had a consult with me. And I was like, well, that's not exactly true. I consulted you on a divorce. I didn't consult you on a protection order. Hmm. So technically I can still represent him and no information was divulged between the divorce and the protection order that would preclude me. So yes, certainly you can do that. But going back to what Susan said, not all attorneys give free consults. So if you're paying 1 hour's worth of the attorney's time for consult at $300 an hour, even you're paying, you know, 15 attorneys, that's $4,500 or something you're paying. Not a lot of people have the funds to do that outright from the start. So they'll limit it. And, you know, that's how it goes with consults, at least.
Jay, thank you so much for all your advice. And I'm so glad you're not charging us by the hour. We like to wrap up our shows with an insight thought, and it's a question I have. And I got to ask us all, what's your favorite lawyer TV show? I mean, Suits was really hot. Meghan Markle, what's up?
People ask me all the time about Suits, but I've never watched Suits. But I did watch, I forget the name of the show. It's the one where she's a lawyer. She's a white girl, but she died in a car.
Oh, the large, and then she became a skinny girl. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Drop Dead Diva.
That's a good one. That's funny.
And I always am so, not appalled, but like, why do they think things happen this fast in real life? Like, they would discover an issue, and then they would investigate, and they would get all their evidence in time for the hearing. I was like, that doesn't happen in real life. I have to move the hearings out multiple times, because if someone's alleging something, I have to go get police reports. And when I get police reports, it takes them 10 days to get me anything. And then when it comes back, it's not even what I'm looking for.
Sorry. Real mom moment. I need to go to pick up my son. So Susan, one word, Kate, one word.
I got mine already. Extraordinary Attorney Woo on Netflix, the Korean K-drama.
Oh, yeah.
So good.
Okay. I went through my Law and Order phase, probably like in middle school. Probably was too young to watch it. Don't know why I was watching it. That was more than one word.
Okay, Suits. But really, Jay, next career is you can be on TikTok watching these law shows and then just doing commentary. Okay. All right. That's it for Model Minority Moms. Thanks so much.
Have a good one.
We hope you found something helpful, reassuring, or interesting in this episode of Model Minority Moms. If you enjoyed the episode, please help us spread the word by texting a friend about our show or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to connect with us, please visit our website at modelminoritymoms.com or follow us on Instagram, where we love receiving messages from our listeners.